Welcome, everyone. It's really good to see everybody here this wonderful Lord's Day, first day of the week morning. A few announcements before we get started. We know that this coming week is going to be very, very busy. There's a lot of things that we're looking to do. We've got the Elders Deacons meeting on Monday. We've got the Centennial Committee meeting on Thursday. We've got Corner Cafe, Men and Women's Breakfast on Saturday. Then as we get into the next week, there's a Young at Heart breakfast on the 17th. That's actually, St. Patrick's Day. There we go. I was trying to say Valentine's Day. I knew that wasn't right. And then the very next day, Friday, we're going to be having a Widow's Walk game night and top of the morning game night. And I've been sending out flyers to all of our widows and widowers. So I'm hoping that everybody can get involved. There's a lot of things to do. There's a lot of folks on our prayer list, and so we need to keep many, many who are on a prayer list, and I know that list will be detailed in greater detail during our worship service the second hour. So let's go to God in prayer and begin our class this morning, and I ask Jim if he would lead us. Amen. All right. Well, if you were here for the exciting class that we had on Wednesday, we talked about the intercession that Abraham had with the Lord on the head of the trail, the road that leads down to Sodom, and how it was that he interceded for the city. He started out with 50. If there were 50 righteous, you wouldn't destroy the city, right? Far be it from you to go against your character and he appealed to God's character as an inferior to a superior would do. And we see that that's the same thing that we have with God. We have no power with God. All we are inferiors working with a superior, one who is creator. Everything that we have is a gift from God that comes to us. And so we have only Jesus and the promise that we have through Christ that he will do whatever we ask in his name and he will do it because that brings glory to the Father, that we too are told to bring prayers and petitions and intercessions before God. And so now we advance in the story here a little bit this morning as the two angels get down to Sodom. And they see the wickedness firsthand there and how the destruction is about ready to happen. And so they're looking for at least 10 righteous. That's what Abraham had interceded for and worked out with the Lord, that if there are at least 10 righteous there within Sodom, that God would not destroy the city. And if you've read ahead, maybe you've heard the story before, you know that he's only going to find 4 there and the city will be destroyed. But God doesn't sweep away the righteous with the wicked, that he finds a way to save them. And so he will bring about this great salvation for them. This answers for us the question, how will Christians survive the judgment? Because we saw with Noah as he got off the ark that there was a covenant that God had made with mankind. And that covenant was to go through all the generations, all the way down through us to the very end of time. And that covenant was that he would never destroy the earth again by water. And so that rainbow that we see in the sky is not for us, it's for God, as we saw when God made that covenant. God says, when I see the rainbow in the sky, that I will remember not to destroy the earth. And so that is a good thing for us when we see that rainbow, that it reminds us that God is remembering the covenant that he has made, and he won't destroy the earth in that manner anymore. But he will destroy the earth, we see promised, by fire. And so what we see in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, those cities in the Valley of Siddim, right below the Dead Sea, is really a taste of what we will experience someday, that there will be a judgment on the earth, that the earth is going to be destroyed by fire. And here we see fire and sulfur being God's means in which he will destroy the earth, but that he will also save those who are righteous in his sight. How do we become righteous in his sight? Can we become righteous on our own? Can we just do good works and go about doing good out in the community? No, that's not how it works. We see that there's no righteousness of our own. We've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. It's only Jesus' righteousness that he's gained for us on the cross and rising from the grave that we are able to take as we are baptized into Christ. We clothe ourselves with Christ. And so we have that righteousness before God. And so when he does bring about this judgment and we are found living faithfully in him, that he will rescue us from that destruction and bring us to be with him one day. So as we study this story, this is not just about Sodom and Gomorrah. This is also giving us insight into what God will do. We've talked about how Genesis is a foundation for really all of the doctrines that we believe in the New Testament. And we can see God building upon these things that we're talking about and helping us to understand our situation in this age that we're living in currently for us. So, we start out our text. It's going to be Genesis chapter 19, verses 1 through 29. And it says, the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, my lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Well, first of all, we've seen the wickedness of Sodom that was first talked about back in chapter 13 and verse 13, kind of giving us an idea that even then it was wicked, and gives us a foreknowledge or a foretaste here of whatever is going to happen that God was going to bring about. Chapter 14 and verse 21, we see when Abram had returned from the defeat of the Mesopotamian kings, that the king of Sodom, who got all of his people and his possessions back, and you know, I don't know that he cared so much about Lot. It doesn't seem like that would be in his character, but he was happy that Abram's force was so great that they were able to defeat these kings that had defeated him and the other kings of the valley. And so he wanted to prosper Abram. Abram at the time said, I don't want to be prospered by you. I only want to be prospered by the Lord. And so he wouldn't take anything from him, lest the king of Sodom had some bragging rights there and said, hey, I made Abram great. So we see also the wickedness of Sodom and how the world may continually try to get us to trust in it rather than in God. And that's always a difficulty for God's people in any age. So we might wonder here by this text, is Lot an elder? We see him sitting in the city gate, and that's often where a lot of business was conducted. The elders of the city would sit there, and they would make decisions, convene their courts in the ancient world, right there in the city gate. If there was anybody who needed something decided, that's where they would go to. And so perhaps Lot has gone from choosing the area of Sodom when Abram gave him the choice of which way he wanted to go, to being a stranger to suddenly being somebody of importance there. I'm sure he came down with all of those flocks and herds that he divided off from Abram. And he has become a man of prominence within the city. He's evidently sitting in the gate of the city, which is where people of prominence do sit. And he shows hospitality, which does show his heart. He's not taken up so much with the wickedness of the people around him. We're going to see a New Testament passage that suggests that he was grieved about all the wickedness that goes on in Sodom, and yet he still lives there. Maybe he doesn't realize he has a choice, that he could leave there and go and be out on his own somewhere, and maybe that would be better for him in the long run. The wickedness that we see around us, do we have a choice with it? Not really. We have no choice but to live here and to continue to hold out the gospel as a light for the wickedness and the dark world around us. Because where else could we go? There's no other place. The whole world is wicked and going to be destroyed. Perhaps there's wickedness in the world around Sodom, but maybe Lot is choosing to stay there because he doesn't know where else to go. So he knows Sodom, Lot does. And he sees these two guys, and we don't know anything about their appearance, but perhaps being angelic beings, they're very handsome in appearance or something, but he knows that these two strangers coming into Sodom just before dark, this is not going to be a good thing for them. And so he goes and he bows himself down, his face to the earth, and he offers his own house as a place for hospitality. This is a place where you can be safe, you can get within these walls, and he knows the city. He knows the wickedness of the city and what these men of Sodom are going to try to do to these two guys if they're trying to sleep out in the town square at night, unprotected. He offers to wash their feet, much like Jesus offers to wash his disciples' feet just before the cross in John chapter 13. So we see here that he's got a heart of hospitality. This is something that Christians are also urged to do in the New Testament, is to offer hospitality. And of course, that takes different forms in every culture throughout the ages until the age that we are in right now. I think it'd be weird today if I showed up at your house and asked you to wash my feet. You might not want to do that. Okay. Then you may rise up early and go on your way. They said, no, we will spend the night in the town square. But he pressed them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. So that's very similar to hospitality today. If somebody offers to do something for you or to give you something, you often say, no, that's okay. I'm all right. I don't need that. I'll just do this other thing instead. But just as good hospitality today, we see Lot pressing them a bit and urging them, no, really, stay at my house. That's much better than staying in the square. He's probably not talking about the wickedness of the people in Sodom at this point, but he's at least offering them a safe place to stay and some food and a place out of the general vicinity of the square. And so he pressed them strongly, so they did decide to stay with Lot. They act like they don't want to put him out, though, and isn't that what we do? Oftentimes, the first time that somebody offers some hospitality to us, that's exactly what we would like, but we turn it down because it's rude to just say, oh, okay, and grab onto it, right? So we would hold back a little bit. Lot doesn't want them to stay in the square. He knows how nighttime is in Sodom, and you don't want to be there. There's a similar courtesy that his uncle Abraham has when he also offered to these same guys under the great oaks of Mamre to come and water their animals, and I'll make you a meal, come and be in the shade for a little while, just enjoy yourselves a bit. And they took him up on that offer, but they're acting a little shy here, maybe testing Lot to see where his heart is, if he's with the men of Sodom or if he truly is has a righteous character. This might also be where we see that in Hebrews chapter 1 verse 14, where people have entertained angels without being unaware. This might be those instances, Abraham and Lot. So it doesn't seem like, I mean, if Lot is maybe an elder at this point sitting in the gate, if he's got a house that's not too far from the square, maybe right on the square, it would seem like he would have some wealth and some power, some position, some influence, and yet it seems like in his household it's only his family. Where are the servants? Are there, you know, is there anybody that's baking for his wife? Is there anybody that, you know, we don't see this here. Maybe they've gone home as it's starting to get dark and they're going off to their own families. I don't know how that works exactly. Unleavened bread, I guess, is, of course, we have that connotation with the Lord's Supper. It has to be unleavened bread and so forth. But here, unleavened, really, if you put leavening or yeast inside bread, apparently, I'm not a cook or a baker too much, but maybe you can say this. But what I've read is that it takes a while for that to rise, and so he offers them unleavened bread because it's a very quick bread that can be baked and give them some nourishment. They don't have time to, you know, wait until the bread has a chance to rise with the yeast and the leavening, and they can bake it. So, unleavened bread. All right. Before dawn, they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man. To the last man. That means every single man in the city of Sodom. Little ones all the way up to older gentlemen. Use that term loosely. All the people to the last man surrounded the house, and they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them." Yes, that's exactly what you think it means. This is knowing without the begetting. Because if you remember back from those genealogies, if you have a King James translation or another translation, you see a lot of, you know, he knew his wife and they begat the son. But there's no begetting that's going to be happening from this knowing that goes on here. So it's after dark at this point. This would be the beginning of the day as the sun went down. And so it's after dark. And that's when those who are immoral in character come out, isn't it? I know that my son working in Parkersburg, he worked the night shift for the longest time. So he'd go to work at 9 o'clock at night and he'd finish up at 7 in the morning. And, he, you know, I did a ride along with him one time. And that was eye opening. You know, I got to see my son in a whole different light than I used to see him. Sometimes he would just stop in the road and jump out and the door wouldn't even close. He'd be there and I could hear every word that was going on. I'm like, whoa, this is interesting. But he says, I could probably pull over every single one of these vehicles that are out right now. I don't have probable cause to do it, he says, but I could pull over any one of these vehicles and find drugs. He says, because, you know, other than some maybe shift workers that are, you know, changing shifts in the middle of the night, he says, there's no reason that at 1, 2 in the morning you've got, you know, these people driving slowly through these really terrible neighborhoods. You know, it's really bad. And I think that's what happens after dark. You get that element that comes out, and that's exactly what's happened here. Immorality isn't tolerant towards those who don't accept their ways. Isn't that true? Immorality likes company. They want you to be as immoral as they are. Because if they have company in their immorality, then they can feel better about themselves because, hey, everybody's doing it. Right? We're made in God's image, and I think there's something within us, even if, you know, we're so far gone that you just join in with all of the men of the city doing what they're doing here in Sodom, that something pricks at our consciousness about, hey, this isn't right. There is a standard of right and wrong. God has set that standard. I'm made in His image, and this doesn't sit well with us. But the more we can get others around us to do the same immoral things, the better we can feel about ourselves. It kind of numbs. It makes like a callus of sorts on our souls. And uh, and makes us feel better about things. So what about Lot? Lot is living in this wicked city, and yet we're going to see in a New Testament passage that he's considered righteous. Still, God considered him that. And so he's playing a very difficult and dangerous game here in Sodom. If he is an elder, if he is sitting in the gate of the city as one who is making decisions for people, then he is reigning over a city along with some others that are all of evil character. That even the fellow elders that would be in the gate with him making these decisions would be in this mob right here outside of his house calling for these two men who came to town that evening to come out that they may know him. These would be the elders of the city. So Lot has probably been keeping very quiet. Sometimes I think as Christians we stay very quiet about our faith out in the wicked world around us. We don't want to cause trouble. We're walking a tightrope, we feel as it is already, in worshiping God and loving God and trying to follow God rather than what we would want to follow and do. And so we keep quiet about it lest somebody might figure it out that we're a Christian. And so Lot suddenly is confronted in a situation here where they're going to know that he's not one of them. Because he's not going to give up these two guys that came to his house. And I'm not sure he knows that they're angels at this moment. I think he'll figure it out pretty quickly here. But right now, he's just working under those ancient laws of hospitality. Here are two men that are innocent. He knows how wicked the city is. They've come into the city. He's done what he could to try to get them to come into his house to be safe. They've gotten there. They're inside the house. They're safe. But now here's the mob outside of his house demanding that he give them over. Here's the point of decision that he has. Am I going to give them over and become like them? Or can I find some way to still keep my neutrality, so to speak, and try to plead with them, try to give them something else in exchange here? Maybe they'll take that and I can still continue to walk the line as one of God's people, one of these righteous people in the world, and they won't figure it out that I'm not one of them. We sometimes face those things. And those crises can be good for us, cleansing for us. So here in John chapter 3, it speaks about the nature of those who are immoral. It says, "And this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his work should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God." And here's the game that Lot's been playing. He knows Sodom is wicked. He knows what they're all about. He doesn't partake with them. Maybe at work or wherever it is, they're all telling the dirty joke off to the side, and you just try not to laugh because you don't want to be seen as being one of them, but you still want to be with them. And you don't want them to figure out that you're living this dual life. And here's where Lot is, and suddenly they want him to be part of the darkness as well, but he's been a light that has the bushel over it. He's been hiding his light for so long. Verse 21 says that's not how we're to live. That whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. He should be showing the inhabitants of Sodom that he serves the true and living God, but that would be to take the bushel off the light and let it be shining on the hill for all to see, and that probably wouldn't go so well for Lot. he's trusting in his protection is in his hiding rather than his protection being the Lord. What do we do? Where are we looking to be saved from as we hide the fact that we're Christians out in the dark world around us? Jim?
Christians have to be careful here. We're told to let our light shine, not to shine our light. There's an attitude thing here.
Okay.
You know, you can be very prideful about your goodness.
It is true.
And so you have to be really humble.
Right.
In submitting to the fact that you are a Christian,
yes,
and you are letting your light shine, but it's not gaining you anything by shining your light and
yes,
telling everybody how good you are.
So for the live stream, if you need that repeated, he's saying there's a difference between letting your light shine and shining your light, because the light doesn't come from us, it comes from God. And so what needs to be seen comes from God. Yeah, but we try to hide that even too, don't we? What comes from God. Yeah. Terry, did you have a... No, okay. Okay, so Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said... Okay, here's his moment here. He's going to try to figure out some way where he can still stay incognito. That he's really one of God's people, one of the righteous people living there in Sodom, in a wicked city, but he doesn't want everybody to know because he doesn't want them to be harassing him or doing worse things to him, you know, kicking him out, doing whatever. And he says, I beg you, my brothers, calls them brothers, he's trying to fit in with them, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. Now that, even to, I mean, our modern sensibilities with the wickedness of the world today, that sounds horrible and terrible. You want to protect your daughters in every single way, right? I mean, there's nobody that's going to mess with your kids. You want to protect them and keep them, but this is ancient laws of hospitality, requires protection of guests at all costs. Lot knew that they didn't want women, perhaps, and so maybe that sounds better coming from Lot, knowing that that's not women they're after. They're after these men, and he knows the nature of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so perhaps by offering the daughters, he would, you know, they'd be like, we don't want these women. We want the guys. They're like, no. Notice he says, don't act so wickedly. In other words, he has put up with a lot of wickedness from them. But now he's trying to get them to realize that their wickedness has gone to the next level. You know, and he's trying to rein them back to this, just their normal level of wickedness, right? That which he has put up with and tolerated. And he's like, hey, I'm one of you. I'm one of your brothers, as long as you stay to this level of wickedness. But if you go beyond that level to this level that you're trying to push for right now, that's too much. And so that's his line of compromise right there. He's trying to get them back to that level of wickedness that he usually sees from them in their actions. I don't know if that was on Lot's part, if this was an offering of his daughters, was something that was beyond what hospitality in the ancient world. Do you know anything? No, Mike? I thought maybe you might. So I didn't see anything written, but I thought maybe you'd have something there. But maybe he knew that they really didn't want women, and so that was something he could offer, and they would reject it, and he would still be okay. But that's not going to be okay, as we're going to see here. Also, women were not so valued outside of marriage as sons were in the ancient world, as in the Western world today. We would value our kids, whether they're boys or girls, a lot more than perhaps they did back in that culture. Okay, Judges 19 is a very similar situation that comes up here when we see that a man finds hospitality near Jebus. He's from Benjamin, and We see that these men of Benjamin are going to be trying to do something similar to him. This is towards the end of the book of Judges, and so we see that this has advanced quite a few centuries from this story of Sodom and Gomorrah at this particular point. But it says here, as they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, surrounded the house, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him. And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brothers, do not act so wickedly, since this man has come into my house. Do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. He's offering his guest concubine. So apparently women were not valued very well in this culture whatsoever. Let me bring them out now, violate them, and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing. But the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until the morning, and as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And of course, if you know the rest of that story, they find her dead. He finds her dead in the morning, and he cuts her up into pieces and sends her off into all the tribes of Israel so that they rise up against the Benjamites, and there's this big civil war that goes on there at the end of the book of Judges. Okay, but back to Sodom and Gomorrah. But they said, stand back. And they said, this fellow came to sojourn, and he has become the judge. Now, he was just sitting in the city gate. He had wealth and position and power, and those who are immoral tend to say, okay, he's an important guy. We're going to leave him alone. That's probably why Lot's not molested himself. But, now, since he's refusing what they want, and these two angels that came to his place, they're suddenly throwing back in his face that he's an alien, a stranger, a foreigner. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. Okay, so no longer does your wealth and prestige and power, none of that matters to us now. We're going to have our way with you as well. Then they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break the door down. But the men reached out their hands. These are the two angels. Opened the door somehow, reached out their hands, brought Lot into the house with them, and shut the door. Okay, so now you got the angry mob outside of the house. They're probably still beating against the door. The situation is far from over. It's only going to be a matter of time before the door splinters and opens. You can imagine the panic within the household there that's going on. What are we going to do here? Lot's been playing this dangerous game for a long time, trying to blend in with the city without becoming one of them. Just as Christians play a dangerous game and try to blend in with the world around us without becoming one with the world. All right, and now here's the moment where it's all falling apart, and they're about ready to be taken as the door is splintered open here. Moses is also accused of being an outsider in Exodus chapter 2, verse 14, when he was raised by Pharaoh's daughter, and he sees the Egyptian beating up one of his fellow Israelites, and he kills the Egyptian and buries him in the sand, and suddenly next day he sees one of his fellow Israelites beating a fellow Israelite, and he tries to stop it, and he says, hey, who made you judge, right? You're an outsider. You're not one of us. He was raised in Pharaoh's household. He's an outsider there. Lot's wealth and position works until it doesn't. Lot is rescued by the angels. God shuts the door to protect him. Think of other times that God has shut doors. We see him shutting the door of the ark. We see in the parable of the five foolish virgins, or whatever you want to call the parable, various names there, where they run off to town to get oil, and by the time they get back, the door is shut. And again, the implication is that God has shut the door and that he doesn't know them and won't let them in to the feast. Yet doors that are shut, God knocks. Think of Revelation, right? I stand at the door and knock. So God won't open some doors. He's got to have us be the one who opens the door. But what does he promise us there in the Sermon on the Mount, right? Matthew chapter 7, 7 and 8. If you seek, you will find. If you knock, it will be open for you, right? So we're able to knock and God opens. If he's knocking, we need to, of course, open to him. But God does shut doors and protect those within, doesn't he? We could even say something there about the plague of the firstborn and the way he protected them with the blood on the doorway. Okay, and they struck with blindness. Okay, so suddenly they're revealed as not being just ordinary travelers here. They struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out groping for the door. He could have just wiped them out early before all the fire and sulfur came down. That would have just, you know, been a matter of hours maybe at the most. But that's not what God chooses to do. He gives them blindness. Think of the blind man in John chapter 9, right? Who he's the one that sees more clearly than the Pharisees and so forth, who are spiritually blind and can't see that God is in their midst. And so they struck with blindness, these guys. They're groping at the door. They can't figure out how to get in. Saul had to be led into Damascus when he was struck blind. And through that blindness, God helped open Saul's eyes and helped him to see what he should be doing. What about this in 2 Kings chapter 6? I've always loved this story here, where they're in Samaria, and the Syrians are all around Samaria here, and he's just shown them that the hills are full of the chariots of the Lord and all of the army of the Lord just waiting there to do God's will. And says, when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, please strike this people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness, and he led them to Samaria. I might have the city wrong on that. I thought it was Samaria, but maybe they're going to Samaria here. So he opened the eyes of the servant to see all of the army of the Lord in the hills, but he struck the army blind. It's just a great story there. Genesis chapter 19 back there, when the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city, bring them out of the place, for we are about to destroy this place because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So while everybody's groping blindly outside, they have no idea what they're doing or where they are, they said, hey, we're getting ready to destroy it. They reveal themselves as to who they are, and suddenly Lot, who must be like in shock, you know, not realizing what just went on, he's got to think, okay, who else? I've got my wife, I've got my two daughters here that I was just about to send outside to these guys. And, you know, who else do I have here? Some commentators think that maybe this indicates here in this verse that Lot had other sons or married daughters, people who weren't living with him, others. I don't know if it indicates that or not. I think they're trying to get Lot to understand that, hey, we're going to rescue you. Who else can you bring with you? And that's really our situation, isn't it? There's going to be a judgment. It's going to happen. And who else can we rescue with us? Who is it that we can preach the gospel to? Who is it that we can also lead to heaven, away from the destruction that is going to happen? Okay, remember there was going to be 10 that were going to be saved, or if there were 10 in the city, that God wouldn't spare the city. The city is going to be destroyed. There seems to be only 4 here, but God will rescue them and not allow them to be destroyed. So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law who were to marry his daughters, up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city. But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be jesting. And I think he goes out. I don't know if it's a back door or if he goes through that one door that he had to his house. And all the men, great, small and great, old and young, are groping in blindness. They can't seem to find it. He just kind of walks around them or through them. I don't know, gets over to the sons-in-law's houses where they are. And says, look, you know, the city's going to be destroyed. You need to come with us. But he seems to be jesting to them. Lot seems to have lost his moral persuasion with his family. Maybe when we compromise so much with the world and we try to blend in with the world so that the world doesn't come down against us as Christians, maybe that hurts our ability to be able to hold out the gospel of Christ to those who desperately need it. Maybe we need to allow a light to be shining through us. Okay, not shining our light, but to be reflecting that light that God has given us, so that when we speak of godly things, that we will be believed. No doubt the sons-in-law were products of their culture. I'm sure the sons-in-law may have even been part of the crowd that was out there groping in the darkness. Who knows? I don't know. Lot's sons-in-law, they were to marry. We were already told that the girls didn't know a man yet. So I don't believe they were married. Probably a lot like how Joseph was betrothed to Mary. And he was thinking to quietly divorce her. Well, we say to ourselves in our Western mind, how is it they weren't married? How can he divorce? But I think this is telling us that they were engaged to be married. In 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 3, knowing this, first of all, that scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing, following their own sinful desires. They are products of their culture. Lot seemed to put up with them as sons-in-law. And back in that culture, you don't leave it up to love. You don't leave it up to the daughters to decide who they want to marry. You're the one arranging that. And yet Lot had picked these guys, it seems, as what the culture would have dictated he did, to marry his daughters. And yet they're very immoral, it seems, and they scoff. Yes, Terry?
When you talk about the concubine that was murdered,
right,
there, that two places in Judges in the latter part, in the 17th and 21st chapters, it says, every man did what was right in his own eyes. And we see that so much in 2022 America.
Everyone does what is right in his own eyes. I mean, that's the very definition of this tolerance and political correctness that we see out in the culture, that they've just renamed it. Yeah, do whatever's right in your own eyes. Yeah. All right, continuing in 2 Peter about the destruction that we're going to see for ourselves here. It says, for they deliberately overlooked this fact that the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God, and that by means of these, the world that was then existed was deluged with water and perished. But by the same word, the heavens and earth that now exist are stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly. We looked at these verses when we talked about the flood a few chapters ago in Genesis, but now we're looking at this in context of that second judgment that comes, that I think Sodom and Gomorrah and the judgment that's about ready to come on that city is a forerunner, a type for us to understand the judgment that will come. Okay, back to Genesis 19. As the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him. Couldn't really flee in the dark. It's not like they have lots of lights and different things. They're going to be stumbling around, running into things. And also the Sodomites are out there groping around. And those who are immoral go to bed when it's light out. Yeah. I would joke with my son and say, well, aren't they, going to bed early so they can get up to go to work? I mean, why are they out now? He's like, no, they don't work. At least not work in the way we're thinking they work. The four righteous would be saved, but the city would not. When we spiritually linger, God works on our heart and in his mercy urges us towards obeying the gospel. He's constantly there being merciful to us, trying to help us to become his child once again if we strayed. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. Notice that God does that. He brings them out, brings them to a certain point, but then it's going to be up to Lot and his family to obey and do what God asked them to do. God gets us through certain dangers, doesn't he? But then he says, okay, from here on out, it's your obedience that I'm looking for here. And as they brought them out, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away." And Lot said to them, "Oh, no, my lords. Behold, your servant has found favor in your sight." God never leaves or forsakes. He brings us through the dangers to relative safety, where we must then choose to obey or act in right ways. Specific commands here. Don't look back or stop. That's what God tells them to do, right? Don't look back or stop. We're given some very specific commands too, in the form of do these things or don't do these things, right? And so we aren't to put our hand to the plow, we're told in the New Testament, and look back. That's not somebody who's suitable or fit for the kingdom of God. Back to 2 Peter chapter 2. "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, if by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued righteous Lot," notice he's called righteous here, "greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked." So that was his situation while he was living in Sodom, as he was really distressed, but he was trying to blend in. For as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. Is that our situation as we look out at the wickedness of the world around us? Are we tormented in our soul because of the wickedness that goes on? "Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment." Okay, back to Genesis 19. "And you have shown me great kindness in saving my life, but I cannot escape to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, the city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my life will be saved." He said to him, "Behold, I grant you this favor also, that I will not overthrow the city of which you have spoken." God knows what we can do, and he knows what we can't do. He strengthens us for the difficult journey. He knows the terror that we're under, as he understands us fully, and he comforts us in the midst of it all, doesn't he? "Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there." Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar. Zoar means small, or is formerly called Bela. We see in chapter 14 and verse 2. God has all under control, but will not forget you. He will not act until it is time, and yet we must act. We must obey. 1 Thessalonians 5, "The day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night, while people are saying there is peace and security. Then sudden destruction will come upon them, and they will not escape." We have no time except the present to be able to obey and live for him and no longer blend into the world around us. 2 Peter 1, "His divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness, through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence, by which he has granted to us his precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped from the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire." He gives us the strength to obey. He gives us the strength to escape the corruption of the world, that we might live for him and be ready for eternity. Okay, Genesis 19, "The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground." And even today, it's kind of a barren wasteland there south of the Dead Sea. This is what's often called the pillar. This pillar here is called Lot's wife. Probably not really Lot's wife, but that's what's called Lot's wife. Gives you an idea here. "But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord, and he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he looked, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived." Jesus intercedes for us as we need to intercede for others in the destruction that will come for us here. Hebrews 7 and verse 25, consequently, is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for him. And I'll leave you with this question. How can you be saved from the destruction of the wicked? Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you so much for giving us a way out, giving us a way out from the destruction that is to come upon the world, just as you saved righteous Lot and didn't sweep him away with the wicked. But you led him by the hand and brought him and his family out of the city. And then you told him, flee, don't stop, don't look back. Father, we see that there are consequences if we do look back, that salvation is not ours, just as it wasn't for Lot's wife. Help us to trust in you and not the world around us for the salvation that we need to have. And it's through Jesus we pray these things. Amen. Yes.